Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Hello again, this is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Ali Maxwell, I've got Liam Tharm, I've got Mark Carey with me, and one more, because one of our big pre-season talking points on the pod was, what will Spurs look like under the management of Ange Postecoglou? How much would he change in terms of Tottenham's tactics from last season under Conte, and how quickly would he look to change things, and would it be slick and smooth or full of teething issues? We found that really interesting pre-season. We're two games in now. To help us answer some of these questions, we've drafted in Charlie Eccleshare, Tottenham writer for The Athletic. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. It's still hard to comprehend how quickly the new manager has changed the mood at Tottenham. Your words, not mine.
Yeah. The expectation, as you guys touched on, and everything certainly I was told, was that, you know, don't expect it to click straight away. It's a very different way of playing. His previous jobs, he started slowly. He was nearly relegated in his first season with Yokohama. But it has happened very quickly. And yeah, we are only two games in, so it might be, I guess, like the new manager bounce we normally think of as like more of a mid-season thing, but it might be that the results are good initially and then there's a bit of a leveling off. But yeah, so far it's been so refreshing. And it's great the results have been as good as the performances. Mm.
Playing the way a Tottenham team should play, said James Moore on the award-winning View from the Lane. It's been great to hear and read and see so much positivity. The fans seem to have bought in pretty quickly. I dare say the players have done as well. And a part of that is what Postecoglou's like, quite aside from football tactics, as a communicator, which is something he wrote about. I think the piece went out this morning. Genuinely one of my favourite things I've read for some time. I'm fascinated in language and communication, shock. And so I found this piece brilliant because it's all of that stuff with world experts in those fields, but through a football lens, which is what we're here for. When did you decide you needed to write this piece in particular about Postecoglou's communication skills?
Soon after he joined, I did a big backgrounder on him. And one of the things that kept coming up was that he is a really great speaker. And so for the last, I don't know, however long it's been, almost 2 months, I've just been sort of keeping that piece ticking along and doing interviews with people about it. And I felt this was a moment because he's just so pitch perfect in what he says. And like after the game on Saturday, he talked about standing on the center circle and just taking it all in and, you know, being so appreciative of the moment. The day before, he talked about a Louis Theroux podcast he'd listened to. Like he just takes you in, and then he was talking about, okay, he was asked about an Australian musician and someone said Peter Andre, and he
did a duet with Carly Minogue. Come on, Richie. No, come on. You guys have got to open your mind, mate. You got a very narrow focus.
What's your
huh? Nick Cave. Thank you, Lynchy. Thank you. Jesus. Talk about open minds, the most closed-minded group of individuals, Jason Donovan and Peter Andre.
He's got a hinterland and he's got a really good delivery. And while sort of doing that big piece, I was alerted to, there are a bunch of videos he's done giving team talks and this sort of thing. And I managed to track down the Australian national team in-house videographer who filmed these, basically, and would work with Postecoglou, would say to him, look, I want to do a team talk on this or a talk in a meeting. Can you go away and find some video clips for me? And there's this famous one he does where he talks to the players about finding who's the person in your life who went above and beyond for you. And he talks about how for him, that person is his dad. And he says, because when we go out there tonight, they're playing not just us, they're playing all those people with us. And it's just really interesting. And I've always been very interested in rhetoric and oratory. I did Latin A level, and you do a lot of it there with Cicero and people like that. If people listen to Football Cliches, they've probably heard me talk about these sort of topics.
Yeah.
So I just thought this was, for me, this was like the perfect piece. This will meld a lot of my interests. And one of the people I spoke to was an expert on public speaking, a guy who, he runs a course on it and is the four-time UK national champion for public speaking. This is a thing.
Brilliant.
Wow. Yeah, you go, they have these competitions. Anyway, he's a four-time winner.
Like, I had a mate who did a public speaking course to try and improve this part of him, you know, further himself, better himself. And the first class or lesson, everyone had to stand up, not knowing anyone else there. And they were given a spoon and they had to talk about the spoon for 5 minutes. Do you think that's...
It is. Apparently there are, there'll be things like that where you, in this competition you'll go and you'll, it will be, some will be, apparently sometimes you're given an actual speech and you have to deliver that, and other times it'll be more of that improv thing of, yeah, go and talk about a random topic.
You know, he's got a very down-to-earth aspect to his personality mixed with clear authoritative personality as well, humour too. I mean, my favourite thing about Postecoglou is his use of the word mate in press conferences, where you just think if a British or an English manager used mate to that extent, it wouldn't land at all. But when he uses it, it's both, you know, it is down to earth, it lands. There's also something a little bit passive aggressive about it.
Scathing.
But I think it's less passive aggressive because it is coming from an Australian, and mate is a more commonly, and he says it's just because he doesn't know everyone's names yet, so that's why he does it. But yeah, I mean, I've had a few mates.
You've been mated.
I've been mated a few times. Yeah,
I can imagine that feels good. Amazing piece from Charlie this morning, which you should go and read. I learned some new words, bathos being one of them, and you can too if you head to The Athletic and read that piece. Liam, what Postecoglou is experiencing in managerial terms is an interesting circumstance, something certainly that's relevant to our interests, like we've already discussed. How quickly do you change things? How do you go about doing that? Is it possible that that could cause you problems in the short term? You know, short-term pain, long-term gain, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's one that other managers like Eric Ten Hag and Mikel Arteta, for example, faced as well in the last few years.
Yeah, they're good sort of case studies for this. Obviously, Spurs are maybe slightly different in the sense that he's had sort of a full pre-season there, and you've obviously got the added impact now of losing Kane so early on, and obviously going through pre-season with Kane and then losing him, I think changes the dynamic of things. And they were so, so reliant on him last season, not just in terms of the proportion of the goals that he scored, but in their overall sort of attacking play. And they are now transitioning to trying to be a more attacking team. I don't quite think that Arsenal or United had to make quite as big jumps as what Spurs have tried to do. There's obviously the quite neat comparison of United having gone to Brentford in game two under Ten Hag and being absolutely demolished and pulled apart in the first half. Spurs going there and controlling large parts of the game. I think as we spoke sort of last week when we said that they struggled at times defensively to defend in the wide areas and they weren't perfect, but Brentford are probably the hardest team to go to and play such good organised possession football. They are the big six slayers, if you will. They beat the top teams sort of regularly. So it's a case, I think, also of finding where the players fit, because remember, Christian Eriksen started match day one against Brighton as false nine in Ten Hag's first game and just increasingly sort of went further down the pitch as the season went on, ended up playing in the pivot in midfield. And from sort of looking back at Arsenal, they won just two of their first seven under Arteta and ended up playing a 3-4-3 all the way into the cup final. And for a good period, you played Aubameyang off the left and they had those goals. I think there was one against Liverpool in the FA Cup and against Fulham that were like these identical build-up patterns. And they got quite good at playing out that way. There's a quote from Arteta in December 2020, so after he'd been in the role a while, saying, "We want to move to a 4-3-3, but for that, you need a lot of specificity in every position, but in five or six positions, we don't have it." We're seeing now even Postecoglou experimenting in real time and sort of, you know, on his right-hand side, he went for a different fullback, this time went for a different central midfielder. That it's going to take time, and performances and results, I think, do look a little bit more separate than what they maybe do at more established teams now, because he just does need to start working things out in this sort of true context.
I was thinking about this earlier. I think it's really interesting, that comparison with Arteta, because Arteta came in, obviously he had no managerial experience. Postecoglou is almost evangelical about the way he wants to play. He's uncompromising. Arteta, no one really knew. I mean, everyone assumed he was going to be a mini Pep. But actually, yeah, that FA Cup win that he had, certainly against City, it was a very counter-attacking setup. I mean, it was the back three. And that worked for them because they kind of had to do that at that time because they didn't really have the players to dominate games. And obviously that then massively evolved over time, whereas Postecoglou's come in and basically said, this is my system, we're doing this straight away. He hasn't come in and been like, oh, we're just going to, you know, evolve to that. Mm. He said, this is what we're going to do.
An evening after Arsenal's game against Palace on Monday night, I know they had a red card and were down for a period of the time, but Arteta after the game came out and said, I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I just can't imagine if Spurs were in that situation, Postecoglou would come out afterwards and say, really enjoyed all the dogged defending. Mm. There's that clip, I think, of him at Celtic where he's shouting at someone for not passing forward enough. Yeah, as you say, sort of being so firmly stuck to the way that you want to play in a good, and this, I imagine at times in sort of 2-3 months, we might be having this discussion about it being a bad thing, because it was a similar thing when Conte first came in, and having a fixed way of playing does mean you can quite quickly establish your ideals, and that is great. And I think they look a lot more adaptable than what they did under Conte, but you can see the same thing being thrown back in the face of what Arsenal had last season as well, of, okay, if you do this in 2 months and you go on a losing run, it's, oh, well, you're not adaptable enough. Suddenly,
yeah, where's the plan B?
It's that big outcome bias of either it's a perfect plan A or you've got no room to adapt and manoeuvre. But the speed at which they've integrated it, and even from, I was at the Shakhtar game in pre-season, and even from then, that seemed so well put in place and so organised. And relationships take time to form. I think we're seeing that particularly out wide, and Udogie and Son in particular, but it's definitely growing from where it was.
Well, that was going to be my question for you, Charlie, of just how much you think that it could work against them. If not, I mean, everything's novel at the moment, isn't it? So it is sort of a surprise factor, but either later in the season, as you say, Liam, or in the second season and beyond. Thinking about his history as a manager as well, in terms of how many seasons he's had at each club, have they sort of been found out over time? I know that obviously Celtic wouldn't be an example of that per se, but you think of maybe transition in wide areas, as you say, Liam, Brentford, they were sort of suspect in that sort of regard. Not necessarily getting the high press right and the opposition being able to play out if they don't quite get it right, or having pressing triggers when they're trying to play out and having the fullbacks tuck in. If the opposition know going into that game that is exactly how they're going to play rather than a Pep, and we always use Pep as the example of being so flexible, do you think that could work against him?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that generally he's done better in his second season, certainly in the last few jobs. I mean, the biggest contrast was when he was in Japan managing Yokohama, and they nearly got relegated in his first season, won the league in his second. With Celtic, they won the league in the first season and the League Cup, and then won the treble in his second and were more established. And that was always the sense everyone gave to me with Spurs, was that wait until the second season, then we'll really know. Obviously, it's slightly different in the Premier League because you get less time. Probably, you know, that there'll be less of a grace period. And what's interesting with him is he hasn't stayed anywhere, certainly at club level, for that long. Mm. He's never really done more than a couple of years. And Brisbane Roy was there 2009-2012, but did a couple seasons at Yokohama, two at Celtic. And also, maybe it's slightly different in those other leagues where the other teams aren't quite so quick to adapt to what you're doing. I do wonder if in the Premier League, yeah, that might be an issue. Because as you say, even last season, Arteta's Arsenal, their biggest pro in probably the first half of the season was that they had a really settled team. That counted against them a little bit maybe once teams did become wise to it. So that will be a really interesting subplot. I mean, Thomas Frank said it on the in the press conference after that game on the opening weekend that basically, yeah, you know, there weren't surprises. We knew what Spurs were going to do. Obviously, it can still be really hard to stop them. But I don't think he's going to compromise. I think anyone who... I agree with you, Liam, because I was saying this on The View from the Lane last week, that there will 100% be a point, could be soon, could be a bit longer, when external pundits are saying about Spurs, they have to compromise. I'm sorry. And you cannot go away from home against that and be that open. That will happen, because they'll lose a game 2-0 or 3-0 against a team everyone thinks they should be. But he just won't listen to that. That won't really be part of his thinking. He's so committed to this way of playing.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast with Ali Maxwell.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hi everybody, I'm Danny Kelly, host of the Athletic's dedicated Spurs podcast, The View from the Lane. Join me, Charlie Eccleshare, James Moore, Tim Spears and Jack Pitbrook for what promises to be yet another rollercoaster season in N17. Will Ange Postecoglou bring back attacking football to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? Every Monday and Thursday we'll bring you top analysis from the best journalists in the game, as well as razor sharp insight, it says here, and of course all the usual View from the Lane gaffes and gags. Come on, you Spurs.
Makes me think of the conversation we had at the end of last week's pod about Basball crossover into football.
Totally.
You know, absolute buy-in, no compromise, certain style of play. I mean, on the style of play, Liam, is there an extent to which the reason it feels quite extreme has to be because of where they're coming from and how they played under Conte? We spoke about it all the time last season of the biggest teams in the country. They were clearly playing a way that was very different, much more reactive, seemingly with fewer attacking dimensions, and they had just like quite bizarre records at 0-0 and then coming back in the second half, and you know, clearly issues. Basically, they weren't a very good team ultimately, but they were also playing a style of play that is fairly unrecognizable now among top clubs. So is there a large extent to which they are just becoming more like the teams that they are trying to chase down? Manchester City and Arsenal and, you know, Chelsea are doing similar, I guess, under Poch as well.
Yeah, I guess so. I've got a very vivid memory of them. I think it would have been round of 16 Champions League at home to Milan. One were done on aggregate. This would be the second leg just before half time, where they are camped just in a mid block for this entire half. Kane is just doing shuttle runs across the pitch as Milan are switching play, and they're just there is no adaptability. There is no sort of change. You're looking at it and you're going, they have 45 more minutes to play, but I don't see how they're going to score in this game. They did not score in either of the two legs. So it's a case of sort of gone from, I think, just trying to avoid sort of complete failure and be so defensively sound first and foremost, that the mistakes that they will now make are things that they would never have made last season because they were never trying to do those things. And at the same time, it's because they're willing to risk all those things to get better attacks, to play through teams, to be more attacking. And okay, that might leave you more open. I was looking at some of the defensive records of Postecoglou's teams, and at times they looked a little bit defensively porous, but they won the majority of games by presumably outscoring the opposition rather than saying, okay, we want to be a defensively minded team first. I know that's kind of come full circle with Pep now, where he's saying, oh, he just wants big defenders. He doesn't really want those. At times he's stepping one into midfield, but that sort of evolution. Spurs just feel like they're maybe quite literally a couple of years earlier from where Arsenal were or United, and obviously City are much further down the line now. So they kind of become useful in terms of size of club, but also quite problematic comparisons, because you can't really compare Spurs to Arsenal now or to Manchester United, because they are further along. They've also had a chance to recruit.
I mean, in terms of the change of style of play, using numbers at this stage of the season is near redundant because, you know, I love talking about sample size, but I'm going to do it anyway. And their opening game, we might have mentioned this last week actually, but their opening game against Brentford had them record 31 sequences with 9 passes or more, which was more than any game in the whole of last season. So just again, when we speak about the speed of the change of the style of play, that alone is just so, so noticeable. I think it's from one of your pieces, Charlie, of just how much Postecoglou likes to do everything with the ball. And I know that the top managers do, right? Like Tuchel said this, Pep said this, in terms of we defend with the ball and we attack obviously with the ball as well. But he said that he absolutely hates it when he doesn't feel like he's in control when his team doesn't have the ball. So there's far more intensity out of possession, but just having a longer sequence of just feeling like there's more control over what you're wanting to do from an attacking perspective. But then if you have the ball, of course, the opposition doesn't. So from a defensive perspective as well, there's just such a clear change. And we're only 2 games in, which I think is really interesting.
Charlie wrote a really excellent piece on this, and it's something that we need to dive into more in terms of the assessment of the fullbacks playing inside a lot. It was particularly Pedro Porro. And there was quite a good Monday Night Football breakdown of this as well. I'm not sure I agreed entirely with what Gary Neville had to say about sort of playing the fullbacks there, and that he's obviously correct. He's a much better player than I ever was. When you're saying about sort of fullbacks playing inside, it's because they
important can't, caveat.
Of course.
Just to get everyone's unsure. A lot of us weren't entirely sure, but now we are.
Well, I feel sort of compelled to do that if I'm going to sort of pick apart his point. But when he's saying that, you know, fullbacks play at fullback because if they were taller, they'd play at centre back. If they're better, they'd be a winger, or they would play at midfield. That probably was true when he was playing and sort of 10, 20 years ago, but I don't necessarily think it's the case now. It's one of the positions that has evolved the most, definitely physically. There's some of, I think, the most athletic players on the pitch to cover so much ground. Quite often you're getting fullback and central midfielder rotations anyway, that it's become one of the most creative positions on the pitch, particularly in the sort of past 5 to 10 years. So I'm not sure I entirely agree with that now, that it's inherently problematic. And there's also the points about them now playing in a position to pin someone inside and make space like Pedro Porro was. I thought he had a really good game, actually, despite some mistakes. But he was also doing a lot of work to pin Mason Mount inside, and Pape Sarr was roaming out on the right.
Just to pick you up on something here so you can explain it to me and maybe some of the listeners, when you say pin Mount inside, is that with Spurs in possession?
Correct.
So that's a movement that Porro would make inside the pitch to pull Mount inside with him and open up passing lanes, maybe out wide to, was it Sarr?
Yeah,
so Kulishevsky.
So Mason Mount, the left-sided central midfielder for Manchester United, was man-marking Pedro Porro, so he was tracking him. And on the right side, Destiny Udogie, Spurs' left-back, Anthony had dropped deeper to defend him. So United kind of adjusted their 4-3-3. They kind of dragged it around to make a 4-4-2 to match up Spurs. And it means that when you've got one player man-marking, they're just going to follow the player that they're marking. So if the fullback comes inside, and Oleksandr Zinchenko has spoken about this in really good depth, that it will pull a player inside, and suddenly you've just got loads of passing angles from centre-back to winger, or loads of space for the outside central midfielder, in this case Pape Sarr, to roam out to the right. You're almost doing it at times to not actually try and play through those players. Jeremy Carragher made a great point on Monday Night Football that Pep first did that, and this isn't a thing Postecoglou has learned from Pep, but this is something Pep did first to stop counterattacks in the Bundesliga as a form of rest defence, to have players inside to congest those central spaces, and then you can access the wingers better. And when, in my opinion, Kulusevski and Son are probably, in Kane's absence, two of the most creative players in that Spurs team, you want to get the ball into them more. It makes perfect sense to me.
I think it's so impressive that Pedro Porro was bought as a flying attacking wing back from Sporting, and he's become an inside fullback. I know we said we're not going to call them inverted fullbacks anymore, but the transformation, there still are teething problems, and you can speak about that, and you mentioned it before, Liam, but to be so contrasting in your style is highly impressive. I think the Gary Neville point you made, I do kind of see his point, in that the physicality is, you've got to be far more, kind of flexible in your attributes as a fullback. I think the same was sort of seen with Trent Alexander-Arnold in the weekend just gone as well, where I just think that having the back to play sometimes is things that, especially Porro, because he's always thinking of having the pitch in front of him, I think is something where it was kind of caught out a little bit, because there's a lot of blindside runs and there's just positions on the pitch that you're just simply not used to quite as much, irrespective of your physical attributes or technical attributes, simply because of the position that you have most often played. But to your point, and to the point I guess I'm making, is that he seems to be adapting to it really quite well in the early stages.
He is. I mean, I think, so I rewatched the game, and to the point that the piece Liam refers to, and it was really, really instructive. And I didn't actually go into I wanted to rewatch it because I thought, I'm sure loads will come out, because they tend to. I think it's a really good exercise. But the thing that did jump out at me straight away was Porro and how much better actually he was than he was perceived. And I think because of the way we over-indexed two moments where he lost the ball and Neville jumped on them. And I think Neville went in, as a lot of people would, with a lot of skepticism about this system of playing inside fullbacks. And so the moment it didn't work, and we've seen it before, it's like when goalkeepers play out and they're not used to it. And it might be fine 90% of the time, but they'll have one shaky moment. They might not even lose the ball, but they'll have a shaky moment. And I was like, that's why you don't do it, because it's too risky. But the thing
all
is,
it takes
like,
is the crowd to go, ooh.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's because a theory of mine with the crowd anyway is because a lot of football we can relate to because we've done it. Most amateur footballers have never played out from the back. So it's terrifying. It's like watching a tightrope walker. And I think it's the same with inside fullbacks now. A lot of people just aren't used to it and it's scary. But you could literally, that chance that Liam refers to, which came just before, in the very first minute was exactly the benefits of a fullback inverting, because you had that overload with Sarr and Kulusevski. And Kulusevski had about four or five goes in the first half where he basically received the ball in space because of what Porro and Sarr were doing. Mm. And it was working perfectly. But yes, the receiving the ball on the half turn is difficult, clearly. I also think I was talking about this earlier, there's such a lag where position, firstly, there's always an assumption that everyone wants to play centrally and that central is like the best positions to play at. I also think there's like a lag, and you know, with fullbacks, we still obsess over, he could play in central midfield. Mm. He's such a good fullback. It's like,
didn't his academy days.
Yeah, it's like, but he doesn't want to, because fullback's a better position and it's more suited to him. Look at someone like Zinchenko or Trent now, what he's doing. I think to Mark's point as well, the adaptation from Porro has been impressive. And it was interesting with Postecoglou, during the preseason tour in Singapore, we asked him, like, you know, do you think you could play Udogi and Porro together? Because I think to most people's minds, it's kind of like, that's crazy. You know, they're both so attacking. And he was kind of like, he genuinely seemed a bit bemused by the question. He was like, I'm like, that would be amazing. What kind of like, what's the problem there?
Thanks for the idea.
Yeah. It's like, of course I would.
It's a complete tangent, really, but anyone who sort of wants to improve their way of looking at football tactically, rewatching a game, particularly when if it's a game that you're initially emotionally attached to, if it's a team that you support, or there's just so much you miss in real time. And there's a great research paper from the 1980s by a pair called Franks and Müller, and this is, in the academic sense, basically the justification. If you go into any performance analysis paper, this will likely be referenced in there somewhere, that found that coaches can recall just 42% of performance accurately, and there have been numerous replicating papers since that have found similar things, and that is, of course, with top-level coaches. So
that's really interesting. Do you know what it does as well? Is it gives you a sort of superiority over someone if you've rewatched it. It's a bit like when you talk about a film and you're like, oh, have you read the book version?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. No, because in the book, it's a bit different. It's kind of like that when you rewatch the game, it just gives you that little bit of an edge. So for that as well, it's worth it.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Tell me what you thought about Spurs defensively in the first half, having watched it back and watched it twice, which gives you twice the authority on this. United had 14 shots in the first half,
yeah,
and you know, quite a few moments where it felt like they were looking pretty dangerous. You know, from a Spurs point of view, why did that amount of shot? I think it was the most shots United have had in a half, maybe away from home, for many, many years. One of those stats.
Yeah.
One of those types of stats.
Yeah,
so how did that come about?
A couple of things. One, which I found quite funny, is that Mason Mount is always held up as a... he doesn't seem to be doing anything. But if you watch really closely, he's actually really, really good. To be fair, Tim, on the rewatch, he was quite good. He was certainly a lot better, and I kind of hated myself for it. He did then fade, to be fair. That did come through. So there are a couple of things. He and United did actually press quite well. The other thing was that Bissouma was quite often isolated. And if you watch the chance where Rashford goes through in the first half and Vicario saves it well from him, that comes about after a passage where Bissouma is almost like a piggy in the middle. There's like four passes where they're just passing around. He's on his own. He's a single press. And I guess that's when you see the benefits in possession when you've got Sarr pulling all the way out to the right. But then there were times when he was isolated. And I think that's something, I mean, he's going to have to get through a huge amount of defensive work.
Yep.
You know, you need to be so good, you know, to be someone like Rodri to play that sole pivot kind of role. So that was something that really jumped out was he was quite isolated.
The United press was interesting because it was both good and very bad for Spurs in the sense it was good that the style they want to play is infinitely better, in my opinion, when a team presses you because it suddenly gives you the spaces. The big thing at Brentford was playing a lot more in the final third, trying to break down the low block, and the goals ended up scoring. One was off a set piece, one was a screamer from outside the box. Here you had Pepe Sarr sort of, you know, crashing into the box with a late run, Ben Davishaw inside fullback getting into the box as well for the second. So they had much better sort of, I think, what we'd call sort of bait and switch attack. So playing heavily down one side, keeping it that way, then playing really nice diagonal, was playing nice switches, and then suddenly you've got time and space on the opposite side. But I didn't think the high line was perfect. I think I counted three times in the first 20 minutes that Rashford got in behind and had sort of 1v1s. I think Vicario made a really good save on the angle, sort of 1v1. And there was a similar header from Bruno Fernandes that he puts over. There wasn't a whole lot to pick out of that. It was more a case just the line was quite high and flat a lot of the time, that the defenders were quite square to the ball. They weren't necessarily in a position where they're sort of ready to run. But I think it's also worth noting that they've played probably the two of, if not the best, counter-attacking teams in the league in their first two games. It looks worse statistically than maybe the performance was. I think if you looked and watched the half-back, you felt Spurs had enough control. There's obviously the chance early in the second half where I think they've just gone 1-0 up and then Anthony curls a shot off the post. So you do start to get into sort of fine margins territory. But there was never a point where I felt like Spurs were repeatedly under siege. They just never really had continued defensive control, at least when they were out of possession.
The high line's interesting to me, though. I was going to get your thoughts on it, Charlie, because you think about Christian Romero obviously playing in a three last season. He was very front-footed, and he is in his nature, but he was also able to be, allowed to be, knowing that he had obviously Eric Dier more centrally to him, and there was two central defenders and he could be the spare and just go high when he needed to. Do you think that, speaking about it before in terms of opposition, knowing maybe eventually to pull Spurs from side to side, essentially, if you could maybe have a centre-forward who you know that Christian Romero is going to go with, and then you maybe have a winger going in behind, that high line and that space in behind could be picked a little bit, knowing Romero's tendency to step out and be quite front-footed.
Yeah, and Van de Ven as well is so quick that he's happy to, you know, he wants to play that really high line. And I think that will be transformative, that they can play with that high line. But it does come with a risk, no question. And there were times when United picked it. And there was a moment as well where Van de Ven came charging out and Rashford nutmegged him in the first half. But that's something Postecoglou is not going to compromise on. You know, he really wants them to push out. I have to say as well, Romero on the rewatch was really, really good. Much better, like quietly, really, really solid in a way, like, because he normally is very noticeable in everything he does because he is so front-footed. But I thought he played with, when he can control his aggression, that's when he's at his best.
He was my one big sort of worry for Spurs in the system in terms of just his sort of, I think, tendencies defensively, that in the Shakhtar game in pre-season, and this is a pre-season game, he got pulled out wide at one point to defend a pass in behind and just absolutely smashed someone. I think he got booked for it, which, you like, if you're getting booked in a pre-season friendly, you've done particularly well. And of course, he had quite a bad record, I think, post-World Cup in terms of bookings and sendings off, including the Milan game and the Champions League. So it's not yet transpired. I mean, whether that will happen, I don't know, and I'm not wishing that upon him. It's just, I think when you do have such aggressive centre backs in a two that, you know, just can be a bit reckless sometimes. I think it's a real shame because he's really enjoyable to watch in possession. And as Charlie says, when you get those games where he controls himself, he's one of the top centre backs, I think, in the entire division. And you almost forget how young he is at times as well, that he's not exactly, in his peak years. So that is something that might come to fruition in later games, but he's been excellent so far.
Okay, so loads of tweaks, both in terms of what Postecoglou is asking his defenders to do, central defenders and fullbacks. Big roles already for Bissouma in midfield, and then Sarr, of course, having a real breakout performance in the United game as well. In terms of the front four, post Kane in terms of what Postecoglou wants his team to look like in that final action, in that final third. Any patterns from what we've seen so far, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, lots of it is about isolating, you know, when you play with those inside fullbacks, is about creating space so that your wingers are one-on-one with the opposition fullbacks. And we've seen that loads. I mentioned it, Kulusevski had a lot of those opportunities in the first half, in particular against United. And I think what will be really, really key is the extent to which he and Son can rediscover the form they had, not last season, the one before, when they were both devastating. I mean, Son won the Golden Boot. Kulusevski was incredible, really, in what was his first half season. But it's not easy. I mean, you need to be backing yourself to win one-on-ones, basically. And I felt Kulusevski was a little bit safe sometimes. He looked a little bit like he didn't want to lose the ball. If he can get that confidence back, then I think that's huge for Spurs. And likewise, Son, who played last year with an injury for a lot of it. But that's what they're trying to do the whole time. And then often what Postecoglou teams, what they want to do is get one winger crossing in, the other wingers attacking the back post. But if they can keep creating, I mean, I guess it's like creating chances for strikers. You know, they always say you want to be getting the opportunities, and they are. They're getting the opportunities to run opposition fullbacks. And that's where it helps, having those inside fullbacks and having someone like Saar come along and sort of occupy one of the other defenders.
I do think they're struggling for box presence a little bit in terms of Richarlison. He just doesn't seem to be having a huge number of touches in open play, which I think is kind of a product of sort of the Postecoglou system. I think it was the same with sort of Celtic as forwards there last season, that they tend to be one of the lower sort of touch players on the team, despite obviously being such a high possession team. The second goal was a nice example of how Spurs' side sort of really changed, where starts on a transition. Maddison actually declines to play a three ball to Son, who looks quite visibly frustrated for a few seconds. I don't know whether he thought he was offside, but even that principle of, you know, everyone sort of screaming out, any chance you get to play a three ball to Son and let him attack space, you would do it. And then they recycle it. They play it around to the right. There's a really nice sort of pattern where they play up from Romero. They set it back and they hit that big switch to Perisic. They can really get those fullbacks at times, as well as the wingers, into those advanced positions. And it's then a discussion, and we sort of said it last week about, it's good when you're getting players on the ball in the box, but at times, do you always want your fullbacks in there? Mm. You know, it has resulted in the goal, but I think Davis ends up really sort of miss-skewing the shot, and it goes in off Lisandro Martinez. So there's sort of maybe some more tedious points that my coach sat on there of saying, it's effective because we've got the ball into the box, but we don't really have our best creative players there to sort of, I think there's only one other player in the box. So there's maybe work to be done on how you get people to flood the box late. You get those wingers sort of running in. I didn't think Son did that very well against Brentford. But again, in terms of against Brentford, they played up against Rico Henry on the left, and against Manchester United was Aaron Wan-Bissaka on the right. So they've played against some really good 1v1 defenders, I think, which also could be more difficult. They almost need to play a system that is a bit more similar to theirs, that is going to not use fullbacks in that sort of traditional way in defensively 1v1, because that will sort of limit their threats. And as Charlie says, it's good having the opportunities 1v1, but if you're playing against some of the best 1v1 defenders, then that's a lot harder to do.
I mean, on the note of Richarlison having a box presence, he's low volume in his touches, but I guess, Charlie, is that his role in a Postecoglou team, to sort of pin the centre-backs, occupy the centre-backs? You don't necessarily need to be the one to, I mean, ideally you want him to score goals, but you don't necessarily need to be the one to take a load of touches. But if you've got those wide players isolating the fullbacks in a 1v1, we saw Kulusevski get to the byline, I think that was for Saar's goal, when you've got kind of late runs into the box from midfielders or fullbacks, that Richarlison is still fulfilling the role that Postecoglou is asking him to do, even if he's not being the one to be the prolific goal scorer, which ideally you would like him to be, and you do want a goal scorer as well. But those runs maybe from cutbacks or late runs into the box, as long as you're getting goal scoring chances, it doesn't necessarily have to be from your number nine.
Yeah, I think that is true. It can be a thankless task, that role. And again, talking about like how roles have evolved, we always thought of striker as being like the sexiest, most rewarding role. But as we've seen with the, you know, we think of that Firmino, Mane, Salah. Firmino was the centre forward, but he would always be the one who would score the fewest goals. You know, there have been Pep teams like that as well, before Haaland and after Aguero. So I think there is an element to which, yeah, a lot of his job is about occupying defenders, occupying space. I mean, he dropped in a few times and linked play reasonably well, but he also, there was one for the Antony chance, he drops in to get the ball and Martinez just cleans him out, basically. And you couldn't help but think, if that's Kane, he's probably going to win a foul because he was so good at doing that. Or if he doesn't, he'll hold him off and play an incredible switch of play off either foot. You know, that's, Richarlison is not going to do that. I think for him as well, like his own feeling of self-worth, a goal would make a really big difference. I know he was pretty frustrated. You could see that, couldn't you, when he came off and he's talking to Emerson Royale and he's clearly...
He's livid.
Yeah, he's clearly pretty pissed off. And he said that to Brazilian broadcasters after the game.
You're right. It is. You can see how it's a difficult role and a frustrating role, even just from a purely selfish point of view. And, you know, strikers are meant to be selfish and they're the ones that only care about scoring goals, etc. All old cliche stereotype stuff. But if a team's attack is so heavily based on the wide forwards, their 1v1 ability, and ideally cutting in and getting good shooting opportunities, or, you know, if not, going down the line and cutting it back or fizzing it across the face, like, not much of that is designed for you to be the one on the end of it. So you just end up making, you know, we're talking about occupying defenders and occupying space. It's not sexy, is it?
No.
It's like,
for a Brazilian,
you know,
as well,
ball to Kulishevsky's feet, 1v1. Richarlison has to make three separate runs, little darting runs, try and do something. The ball's probably never going to get anywhere near it.
I think it's also worth just noting the fact that Kane scored 43% of Spurs' goals last season. That was the most of any player in the league, even more than Haaland's proportion of goals for Manchester City. So the bar for Richarlison, I think, is set just ridiculously way too unachievably high, regardless of how good he is. I think last season was also a result of Son and Kulusevski not having the form that they've had previously. And really, you could say if three of them got 10 goals each, that would actually replace Kane's goals from last season, and feels like a much more achievable bar and just a more balanced attack, because the whole point now of the system is we're not reliant on one individual to play through balls and to score goals and to hold up our play. We've got a more balanced attack. We can create chances against different teams in different ways, and through different sides of the pitch and through different personnel when you drop in players and you bring them out.
And a lot of the creative passing burden that Kane has left behind can be shouldered by James Maddison on early evidence, Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, he's been so good in both games. I've said this before, but he, you know, you sometimes get new signings, they just feel, they click instantly, they feel like they've been there for ages, that they just feel right, and he's definitely in that category. He's come in and made a huge difference and has shouldered a lot of that creative burden, and I think will continue to do so. And it's why this injury that we're worried about and that we'll get a formal update on tomorrow is preoccupying Spurs fans, I think, so much, because he's made such a good start, and with Kane gone, he is that, the guy you look to create chances. I think he's the technical leader for this team as well. He's one of the vice captains. And they've got a bunch of central midfielders, but replacing him would be difficult. I mean, one thing that's been suggested, could Kulusevski come in and play that role and then they play someone else out wide, maybe Manuel Solomon? But it's a fairly specialised role. So, yeah, I think Maddison has made the Kane departure that little bit more palatable.
So we've had two games in which they've played: Brentford away, very tough test. Manchester United at home, tough test. They've come out with 4 points. And Liam, the next few matches for Spurs, we're going to learn even more about Postecoglou and his style of play and what's working, you know, definitively, and again, which areas they may be tested.
Yeah, they've probably got some harder defensive blocks to come up against now. They've got Bournemouth away next up, who high-press Liverpool really, really well at Anfield. So that will be a really interesting test. They go to Fulham in the Cup, who, of course, had a fantastic mid-block for almost the entirety of last season, playing a very similar way. They go to Burnley, and then they've got Sheffield United at home, which will be, I think, one of the most difficult defensive blocks to break down, because they will go 5-3-2. It will be very much a 5-3-2, not a 3-5-2. Very similar to how they had to try and break Brentford down. And then straight after that, they go into a North London derby, and then they face Liverpool, which feel like two really big litmus tests of how this team can play in big games. I think it's also worth noting that these have been two really, really young Spurs teams in terms of, well, one, Premier League experience, but also just age fundamentally. Only Arsenal have had younger starting 11s in both games this season than Tottenham. Their two starting 11s had average ages of 25.2 and 25, which are among the top six, or the six youngest of any of the starting 11s in the Premier League so far this season. And I know you take Kane out of the team, does make it younger anyway. He would have upped that a little bit. But Spurs were the fourth oldest in the league last season, and that is not a predictive success at all when you look at who finished where and their average ages. But I think Postecoglou has mentioned that a lot, about he's particularly happy with how the team is playing because they've got young players, or they've got players that are making debuts. So
I mean, yeah, they had three players in their first game playing their first ever match in the Premier League. And one of those was their goalkeeper, one was a centre-back, one was their left-back. That's pretty high-risk stuff. Then Maddison's making his debut for the club. Obviously, he's a lot of experience. That's four debutants. Then Sarr comes in at the weekend. He'd started two Premier League games before the United one. So it is. And what's interesting as well with the point about the type of opposition they've played, I know at Spurs there's a kind of excitement at what they'll be like against a team who attacks them, because it will be very different. And obviously, yeah, Brentford are one of the, as you say, Liam, one of the toughest teams to play in that regard. So I guess that's another subplot maybe to that North London derby, because Arsenal will attack them. I mean, that game will be... Because I think the next three games are against Bournemouth, Burnley, Sheffield United, and, you know, they, in theory, could be undefeated from those. They could win all three, which does then set up that North London derby in September very nicely.
And in the next week or so, the transfer window is still open, and Daniel Levy will be pretending that he doesn't have £100 million burning a hole in his pocket. I realise that's not how transfer fees are done these days. but what do you expect the last week of the window to look like? Do you think Postecoglou is a manager that is demanding of his board, of his owners, in terms of getting players in? He strikes me as a guy who just wants to work with the group, mate.
Yeah, he's quite straight talking. I mean, I think he'll say, I've been pretty clear about what I want. They want and need another attacker. They're definitely one short in that regard. And whether that's Brennan Johnson, who's primarily a winger who can play centrally, or it's a forward who can also play out wide. I mean, I think now most teams have more of that kind of rotating cast of forwards who can play in a number of positions to give them that flexibility. But that's definitely a priority for them as the transfer window ends, and also change around at centre-back, because they've got all of Tanganga, Sanchez and Dyer. They would be open to selling. But obviously, if they were to do that, they need to bring someone in. And also, it's partly they want to bring someone in, but they can't bring someone in until they've moved on some of those players. So outgoings is a big priority for them as well over the next week or so.
Yeah, I mean, make what you will of sort of transfer links and rumours. I personally quite despise them. But I thought that seeing Foley and Balogun connected to Spurs was interesting. As sort of a profiler forward they might go for. Very much a box forward in France last season. Scored a real nice sort of variety of goals. A lot of one-touch finishes. Left foot, right foot header, you know, albeit a more transitional team and what Spurs are now. But I thought it's an interesting comparison to Brennan Johnson, who I think is excellent, but did a lot of his best work, I think, playing off Taiwo Awoniyi at Forest, almost playing him and Morgan Gibbs-White as two number 10s. I think he's great and he's electric, but he might almost suit the winger role more than sort of playing what the Maddison role is. So whether he can improve his possession game, you know, that remains to be seen. Again, he's a young player that would fit that sort of recruitment from Spurs in that regard, and looks really exciting. But yeah, I think maybe some more depth at number 9, however they go about doing that is, I think for me, that would be the first place I'd start.
In terms of the depth in wide areas, you've obviously spoken about Kulusevski and Son. I don't know, other than Manor Solomon, I don't know whether there's really anyone else who could do that. So maybe strength in that area as well.
Brian Hill when he's fit.
Yeah, that's a good example as well. One player I thought it could be a sensible transfer, there's no sort of rumours attached to it, I thought would be Bradley Barcola at Lyon. He's a really good kind of tricky winger, quite pacey, really good in his off-ball running. He's got 0.8 goal involvement, so goals and assists per 90 last season, which is pretty strong. So really good output. 5 goals and 8 assists, but he's only 20 years old. And I thought he'd be the sort of the profile of player that could quite suit Spurs. And I know that he can play off the left and off the right as well. So that could be, you know, the type of profile of player.
Quite hypothetical, Charlie, but do you get the sense that it would be more likely to be a early 20s, grow and develop, you know, bright young thing, rather than let's get a peak age player with Premier League experience like James Maddison and let's maybe spend a lot of money on them?
Yes, although I mean, one that they are looking at and have looked at is Ivan Toney for January. That would be the one who fitted more with the, you know, big money ready made. But I don't think they're going to just rush into signing that kind of player. I think it will be someone who's younger. I mean, the other one they've been linked with a lot and are interested in is Gift Orban. As ever with that kind of signing, his numbers are incredible, but it's how much can that translate? But I think it'll be someone more in that kind of mold. Someone as well who's adaptable and wants to play this kind of football. They're not going to go, they've been linked with Lukaku, well, that's not going to happen. You know, that's probably like the other extreme, I guess. Yeah. You know, someone who's very experienced and is, you know, predominantly about scoring goals. I think it will be someone who's more versatile and can play in a number of roles.
Hello. Hello, listeners. If you're someone who is just too busy for a regular length podcast in the morning, we have something for you. The Daily Football Briefing brings you bang up to date with the biggest football stories in just over 10 minutes. Whether it's David Ornstein on the latest big signing or Matt Slater on a takeover saga that won't go away, we'll bring you right up to speed all before you've finished your first coffee of the day. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the usual platforms, and make sure to like and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.
One departure this summer that remains to be seen of its impact was the set-piece coach, Gianni Vio, who Mark Carey was able to sit down with to chat about the other day. That's a bit of fun. You must have been pretty chuffed to get that access. How did the discussion go?
Really good. So, so insightful. He was really good with his time and just being able to get an insight into, yeah, all of the work that he does. We didn't go through every routine because I come to understand that there's upwards of 4,000 or 5,000 routines that he does. But we spoke about, obviously, specifically with Spurs last season, how much they profited from, especially with corners, balls to the near post, flicked on for a back post, which they did against Wolves, Newcastle and Chelsea, I believe, and strength in that area, and just how much they were one of the best. They were the best in the Premier League in terms of per set piece, how many goals they scored.
Let's hear it in Vio's own words.
It's really my dream to go with one club and to have a contract like a striker, no, like a coach. But this is my dream. I would like to go to the club. Sorry, I am a striker. I am a 15-goal striker. I think in the future all the team need one set pieces coach, because a set piece is a game into the game. It's completely different because the ball is stopped. We decide who is the taker. We decide how many players go in the box. And we decide also the space to attack, the timing. All change. It's a different game into the game. Now is also my job, but I don't consider the job because I worked 37 years in the bank. The bank don't know, but I work 37 years. But the statistics said that 30% or more goal is set pieces, for or against. If you don't train, you don't use this 30%, you don't use all the power of your car.
I looked into the numbers in Tottenham last season that had 17.1 set pieces per goal, and that was the best in the Premier League. First of all, you must be very proud of that.
Maybe I am a lucky man, because we last year we don't had a lot of training, but we scored a lot of goals. My first experience with the Italian national team, we won the European. I think I am lucky, but to be lucky is a quality.
Well, because sounds like it.
Because really, I don't think we scored a lot of goals last year. We was first in the table, but it's not up to me. It's because really our player was really strong.
Two games worth of set pieces isn't much, but Spurs have scored a set piece goal already. 11 set piece shots so far. Only one team have taken more through two games. Charlie clearly lost something big in terms of Harry Kane and his ability to get first contact, both going forward and also defending in his own box. But they certainly gained something in Madison's delivery.
Yeah, it's a shame that Madison and Vio never got to work together. I mean, Vio was loved by the fans, honestly. And you quote in the piece the Kulusevski bit after, I think it was when they beat Wolves last season, with one of those set piece goals and him saying, like, give the man a pay rise.
Yeah.
he really was like a fan's favourite. So I love really Mark's interview. But yeah, I mean, Madison has come in and you do just, there's that little frisson of excitement whenever they get a set piece. And Spurs as well, bear in mind, have an uneasy relationship with corners. I mean, for years they're Christian Eriksen, who there was this sort of culture war about his near, or not even a war, because it was almost unanimous. Everyone was so frustrated by the fact his corners wouldn't be the first man. Obviously, as I'm sure Vio would tell you, that's the area where you want to, that's where most corner goals are scored from, is if you get, there's a spot, isn't there, where if you can hit it, you've got a really good chance of scoring from, normally because you'll get, because it enables you to get that first contact.
Yeah.
But it became such a gripe amongst Tottenham fans.
It was interesting though, because since chatting with Gianni, I have had a more watchful eye over every set piece across the Premier League, but specifically with the Manchester United game, there did seem to be a replication of that. Madison taking it, Richarlison was the one who peeled over to the back post. So the routine did seem to be similar. So I suppose, you know, he's shown them the playbook from last season. So it's not like they don't know what to do. They've got a largely a similar set of players. So I'm sure they are still using those routines. And because I was watching on, it did seem to be that the patterns were quite similar to last season. So with a set piece taker as strong as Madison, you know, look out for them.
And although he left in the summer, I think I'm right in saying he's not like attached to Conte necessarily. He's not sort of necessarily stuck with him. So very much a free agent.
Yeah, he signed off by saying, if you know any Premier League clubs who want a 15-goal striker, then give me a call. So I think he's 70 years old, available for work. And he's just so, he exudes such enthusiasm when you talk to him about set pieces. And considering, as he mentioned, just how important, how much of a big part of the game they are, how still kind of to this day underappreciated they are. So any opportunity to get an edge, which we're all about sort of discussing on this podcast, then it's so key to do. And he's a real big advocate of that.
You can get an edge on football content by reading The Athletic. Head to theathletic.com/tactics. You can read Mark sitting down and chatting with Gianni Vio. You can read Charlie, all things Spurs, but particularly that piece I mentioned about Postecoglou, the communicator. I'm sure Liam's doing some good stuff on there as well. Thank you so much for listening this week. It's been great fun to hear about and delve into Postecoglou's Spurs. We'll be back again next week, so don't miss it. The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.